Well, let's go ahead and have our Bibles open to 1 Kings chapter 2, and we'll look at verses 2 through 4. 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. And the context of this passage is that David is now lying on his deathbed, speaking to his son and chosen heir, Solomon. As he's speaking to his son, he offers a few final words of advice. He says to his son, "I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so that the Lord may carry out his promise which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel." Now, before we get to the main point of this lesson, I think there's some things that we can start off, some observations that we can offer based on this passage. First of all, I like that David acknowledges that kings are no better than other people. That he's going the way of all men, he says. It's my time. That just because he's David and just because he had a valiant life and just because at one point he was strong enough to kill a bear and a lion by himself and just because he was strong enough to slay the giant Goliath and that Saul killed his thousands but David killed his tens of thousands, he knows that he is going the way of all people. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter what kind of a house you live in or what kind of a palace you live in David's case. It doesn't matter what you did in this life. If you don't have a reputation in God's eyes, if you don't have character, there's really nothing that you're going to be able to carry with you to the afterlife that God is going to care about a whole lot. David is going the way of all people. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27 says that we all die, and after this comes judgment. And that's something that you can't avoid. David knows he can't put this off forever. And there's actually something really comforting and reassuring about the way that David is resigned to his death. A lot of us do everything that we can to avoid it. I'm certainly not saying that David was eager in any way to die, or that David was not going to choose to continue living if he had the option to do so. But there's something really reassuring that David knows probably in the next couple days, sometime in the near future, my life will be over and it is time to set things in order. It's time to talk to my son to give him some final words of advice to make sure that things in this life, in my household, in my kingdom are ready so that when I die, inevitably, things are not going to fall apart without me. You know, and oftentimes we try to put off death or avoid death. We don't want to talk about death. We don't want to confront it. We don't want to be honest about it. What ends up happening is that when we're not honest about death, we end up leaving a mess for our kids to clean up after we're gone. Another point here. With little time left for flowery speeches and pleasantries, I like that David goes straight to the heart of the issue. That he's not gonna waste his time trying to say pretty things to Solomon. He's going to tell him substantial things. He's going to get to the meat of things. At the core of it, he tells Solomon that the absolute essential here, the thing I want you to know with no time left, is you've got to walk in God's heart, in God's ways. You have got to stay on God's path. You have got to do what he says. To walk before the Lord, he says, in truth, with all his heart and with all his soul. And he hearkens back to the old law, too. He says, just as God has written, just as it says in the law, you're supposed to follow God and his word. I think what he's doing is going back to that passage in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, beginning in verse 14, going on through verse 20, there's a passage there that gives instruction to a time when there would be a king over Israel. I think it's interesting that when 1 Samuel 8 comes along, God isn't surprised. When the Israelites ask for a king, God isn't fumbling around going, "Well, I didn't think this would happen." No, all the way back in Deuteronomy, God already knows there will be a time when you will have a king. You'll ask for a king, but I want you to understand some things. That king needs to know the law. In that passage in Deuteronomy 17, he makes it clear that king needs to know the law. He needs to handwrite his own copy of the law before he becomes king. He needs to know the law. And he needs to not be a greedy person. He needs to not be a lustful person. He needs to not be a wasteful or an opulent person. He needs to not multiply things for himself, multiply wives, multiply horses, multiply gold and treasures and storehouses. That is not the kind of man that is supposed to be the king over God's chosen people. Now, we all know Solomon's life, of course. We all think, actually, that Solomon's first mistake was the way that he became a polygamist. I would actually contend that Solomon's first mistake was violating another part of this Deuteronomy 17 passage. The law clearly says he's not supposed to multiply horses for himself or buy horses from Egypt. And you read that one of the very first things that Solomon does when he becomes king is that he accumulates horses for himself from where? From Egypt, of all places. Before he becomes a man with 700 wives, Solomon had already violated the Deuteronomy 17 passage. He could not listen to what his father was trying to tell him, that you need to go back to the law and read that passage in Deuteronomy 17 and know it by heart and walk before the Lord in all of His truth. It's really noteworthy that David goes to such lengths to explain how thoroughly his son must obey God. And as we've already pointed out, very sadly, in spite of what his father had said, in spite of what the instruction of the law said, Solomon couldn't keep that charge. He could not walk before God in all truth, with all his heart, and with all his soul. And we know that by the end of things, by the end of Judah's history, there was not a man sitting on the throne in Jerusalem. Now, in particular in this lesson, this is really where I really want to get to the heart of things here, is I want to focus on a phrase that David uses in speaking to his son Solomon, where he says, "Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man." You know, when I read this passage, I wonder, what was it about David that makes him qualified to teach us about being a man? What was it about David that makes him qualified to say to his son, "You have got to be a man. Be strong and be a man"? Was David much of a manly man? And the reason I bring this up, I think the reason why this lesson is so significant to our time period, is that manliness is a very hot topic. If not a hot topic, then at the very least an interesting topic. Manliness is in the news a lot. There's blogs about manliness. There's really interesting websites about the art of manliness. Everybody's got to, you notice everybody in like a rock band or, you know, an alternative rock band has to have a long beard now. Everybody has to have a beard to be manly. People wear t-shirts about their beards or their handlebar mustaches. Beer commercials show us what it means to be manly. Culture shows us what it means to be a manly man. Manliness is a very, very interesting and curious topic to us right now. But does our culture really know what it means to be a manly man? And when I read this passage and David telling his son, "You need to be a man," I wonder, what was David's definition that he was using? What kind of manliness is he trying to get Solomon to understand? And as men in the 21st century, or anybody in here who has a relationship of any kind to a man, what are the lessons that we're supposed to take away from it? I suppose one of the earliest examples of manliness that David would have known from his own life was the Philistines. Now, when David becomes king over Israel, we know that the Philistines are his sworn enemies. The Philistines give him trouble for many, many years into his reign. And he is known by the Philistines as quite a villain from their perspective. And yet, as a young man, David would have seen examples of the Philistines. He would have seen them as, within the context of their time period, as really the paragon of manliness. So what was it that David might have seen about the Philistines that would have shown him manliness? Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 4. And in 1 Samuel chapter 4, notice a story. I suppose at this point in David's life, he would have been a very, very young man, possibly not even born yet. But even if he wasn't alive during 1 Samuel chapter 4 and the events therein, there still would have been a really, really fresh memory in the minds of the Israelites. His contemporaries, his father and his grandfathers and their contemporaries would have probably told this story to David as a youth. Let's begin here in verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 4. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer while the Philistines camped in Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." What they really want is they want a magic talisman to come to their battlefield. They want the secret weapon. They probably saw Raiders of the Lost Ark and thought, "We can do that. Maybe the Philistines' faces will melt." So they want the Ark of the Covenant to come to the battlefield with them. Let's pick up here in verse 4. So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant. Now in verse 5, let's look at the Philistines' reaction to this sudden turn of events. And it happened as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp that all Israel shouted with a great shout so that the earth resounded. Verse 6. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into their camp." They said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness." And notice here in verse 9, "Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight." And by the end of the day, it didn't matter where the Ark of the Covenant was, because it didn't help the Israelites one tiny bit. They lost the battle. Horribly so. It was a catastrophe for them. They even lost the Ark of the Covenant itself. Phinehas and Hophni died. Eli, their father, found out and he fell backward off a chair and killed himself. This was a really bad day for Israel. The Philistines showed them who the real men were on the battlefield. And in particular, that phrase in verse 9, "We need to be men and fight." And it was the Israelites who went home that day with their manliness taken away from them. And again, I think the point that we want to make here is that David would have heard this story as a young man. He would have heard this story. He would have heard what the Philistines said about being men and rising up and fighting so that they would not become slaves themselves. And that would have left an impression on the young man David. I suppose David might have even had a little bit of admiration for his foes. He might have seen their manliness and thought, "Boy, if only God's people could be manly men like that on the battlefield." Maybe a couple practical applications to think about. Isn't it sad when the enemies of God show more fortitude and valor than God's own people do? Isn't it sad when God's enemies in the 21st century show more fortitude and valor than we do? Would we be willing to defend the faith to the death? Would we stand up for truth even if it cost us a great deal? Friendships, relationships, a job, status, reputation with the world. What are you willing to sacrifice for the sake of the gospel? What are you willing to give up to be a valiant warrior for the faith? I'll tell you what, there are some enemies of the gospel who I admire a great deal, not because of what they believe in, not because of what they stand for, but because they give themselves 100% to their cause. There are atheists who would die for atheism. There are cult leaders who will commit suicide because of their psychotic beliefs. There are enemies of the gospel that will go that far for what they believe in. Would you go that far for what you believe in? Or are we like the Israelites from that time period? We believe that because we have God's magic talisman, we hold a Bible in our hands, or go to church every Sunday, or have a nice building, that somehow will protect us from the fight that we are expected to engage in with the world. You know who the manly men were on that day? It wasn't God's people. It wasn't the people who knew the law. It wasn't the people who had the Decalogue written on their foreheads. It was the Philistines, uncircumcised pagans. They were the manly men that day. Take courage and be men, O Philistines. Be men and fight. Now, the manliness of our enemies, though, I think has a built-in challenge. That when you see the fortitude of your enemies, rather than running away from the challenge, I think that we need to look at that as a call to fight. I've always liked the New Testament passage in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13. I love the way Paul puts it. It's very similar to, I think, something David might have said in his time period. He says, "Be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, and be strong." Now I want to make sure that we understand, this isn't just a lesson for men. Okay, there's certainly plenty of lessons, plenty of spiritual applications for any woman as well, children included. So this isn't just a lesson for men, but I don't want to make any kind of false advertisement here. My primary concern is with men in this lesson. Because men are on the defensive in our culture. Men are on the defensive. We are told by television, by our peers and our contemporaries, by our politicians and our celebrities, what it is supposed to be a man. And here a Bible passage comes right out and says, you need to act like men. We need to make sure our definition is calibrated correctly. When we read this phrase, act like men, be strong, stand firm in the faith, are we thinking that, okay, act like men, Homer Simpson. Is he our culture's greatest example of what it means to be a man? Yeah, he's probably certainly the most typical example of what it means to be a man. And so when I see act like men, I need to know, what does that mean to act like men? What does it mean to act like a man? I need to know what it means to be a man. We'll save that thought for a minute, though. Because we're going to deal with that idea of the true definition of manliness doesn't fit culture's definition at the end of the lesson when we make some practical applications. First, let's go back to David. Let's go back to the story of David. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 17. And let's see an example of perhaps the manliest man in human history by the world's standards. When you think of manly men, again, by the world's standards, what comes to mind? Maybe someone who's about 10 feet tall. Maybe someone who's a valiant warrior. Someone who's brash and arrogant. Someone who gets his way all the time. Someone who's so confident that he can put himself out there and challenge an entire army to a duel and go to sleep every night soundly, confidently. I'm thinking of Goliath. The very name strikes fear into our hearts. The very name has now become a word for gigantic manliness in our language. What do you think of when you hear the word Goliath? We name elephants Goliath. So in 1 Samuel chapter 17, we know the story very well, I'm sure. In the valley of Elah, you have the Philistines on one side of the valley. You have the Israelites on the other side of the valley. They are engaged in a tight bout. It has become a stalemate, though. Every single day in the midst of the stalemate, Goliath, the chief warrior of the Philistines, comes out from his ranks. He stands in the middle of the valley and he challenges the Israelites. He says, "If any one of you is strong enough to fight me, you come out here and fight me. If any one of you can kill me, this whole army of Philistines will become your slaves. We will all serve you if you can kill me. But if I can kill you, the reverse will be the effect." And every time Goliath comes out from the ranks of the Philistines, the Israelites take a step back. They take a step back, hold their breath, look around, and hope that nobody is foolish enough to accept the challenge. So in the midst of this stalemate now, the young man David, the youngest of his brothers, comes to the battlefield with some provisions for his three oldest brothers. While he's delivering these provisions for his brothers, he overhears the Goliath come out and present his challenge. David is naturally incensed by it. It bothers him a great deal that the Israelites are just standing by while this, in his own words, this uncircumcised Philistine mocks us and taunts us. So David very boldly says, "I'll take his challenge. I'll accept the challenge and I'll face him in combat." Now we know how the story goes. David meets with Saul, the king, who has some reservations about this idea of a shepherd going out and facing a man who is a professional warrior from his youth. And yet David shows a great deal of confidence in God, in what will happen. Let's actually go to 1 Samuel 17, and let's read a few verses out of this chapter now. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, let's pick up in verse 31, if you will. Verse 31. "So when the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail on account of him.'" Kind of log that away, that phrase of "let no man's heart fail." And we're going to talk about that in a moment. "Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." David proceeds to explain to his king, "Actually, there's more than meets the eye with me. I was in the fields with the flocks, and a bear and a lion came up on separate occasions, and I killed that bear and I killed that lion all by myself." I like the way he puts it here in verse 37. "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will also deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." He is confident that one enemy is as dead as another. If he can kill a bear, and if he can kill a lion, what does this Goliath have to offer to him? So Saul says, "The Lord be with you. Go ahead. God be with you." And instead of pitting his physical strength against that of Goliath's, David finds himself some smooth stones from a brook, and he uses his mind, his wit. He uses precision, thoughtfulness, nuance to defeat the giant. Look what he says here in verse 44. Actually, let's pick up here in verse 42. "When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy, with a handsome appearance. And the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?' and the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." David said to the Philistine in verse 45, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted." Goliath loses his head by the end of the day. Again, with precision rather than brute force, David overcomes an enemy much larger than himself. Now, let's not have this idea that David was like some like 7-year-old kid or something, the way he's typically depicted in like Sunday school curriculum. He's not some like little 7-year-old kid or anything like that with a slingshot. Anybody who can kill a bear and kill a lion is going to have his own strength. He's handsome also. Even the Philistine recognizes that David is a good-looking man. But it's interesting, isn't it, that it wasn't his strength, which he had. It wasn't his good looks, which he had, that made David a manly man. I think it all boils down to what he says to the Philistine in response to the taunting. "You've got your spear. You've got your sword. You've got your giant javelin. You're 10 feet tall. You can kill anybody, and you probably have killed just about anybody that you've met on the battlefield. But I have something that you don't have. No matter how manly you seem, Goliath, I have something to my manliness that you will never understand. The Lord is on my side." Sometimes the Christian man doesn't seem like a manly man by the world's standards. Jesus didn't seem like a very manly man by the world's standards. A man who was tender with children. A man who was eager to forgive others who harmed him. A man who was willing to give of himself without a fight, without defending himself, without saying even a word in his defense when people accused him of heinous crime. Jesus wasn't much of a manly man. He wandered around, walked everywhere, talked. He talked. Manly men aren't men of words, we're men of action. We're men of violence. We're men of force. We get what we want. And if we don't get what we want, we coerce others into giving it to us. We're Goliaths. Goliath is a man by the world's standards. And then you've got people like David and Jesus. Shepherds. Poets. Men of words. Jesus was so tender. He was so tender. David was so sweet, so melodious in the things that he wrote. A man who could kill a bear and a lion and a 10-foot-tall giant could also write such sweet words as Psalm 23. David knows that in the hearts of men, we are prone to fail. Which is why he said back in verse 32, "Let no man's heart fail." We fail. We are prone to fail. We need leadership. Which is why David was such a great king. Because he was a shepherd first and foremost. Before he was ever a warrior, before he was ever a king, before he was even a husband or a father, from his youth David was a shepherd. We need the shepherd spirit. Not just in our elders, literally speaking. Not just in men as heads of a household, but all of us in our own way that we serve, in our own way that we lead, in our own way that we are examples. We all must be the shepherd. We must find the leadership qualities within us, though they might seem unnatural at first, and we must live up to those qualities. It is not armor. It is not sword, it is not stone that gives us victory, but it is God who works through us. This is not the last thing that we'll notice from David's life, though. We find out from David's life that true manliness is contagious. that other people are actually quite drawn to true manliness, not repulsed by it. I don't know about you, but sometimes I look at the idea of manliness by the world's standards. It repulses me. The excess. I know we like our pickup trucks. Pickup trucks are awesome and everything. But you know, it's always funny to me. It's always funny to me to see someone who's got like the gigantic pickup truck that's got the lift on it and it's got like, you know, a tow cable and everything. Like, have you ever used that tow cable in your entire life? And it's like when you see a truck that's got like a tow cable on it and like a roll cage and like, and it is spotless, like waxed, and it's all shiny, like, yeah, I don't think that you have taken that thing out mudding recently, have you? We like the image more than the function. I was at a burger joint one time. And you know how it is. You see the guy who pulls up in his red Dodge Viper. His red Dodge Viper. And his arms are as thick as my waist, which really isn't saying much. But, you know, his arms are as thick as my waist. He's got tattoos all the way up. And he comes in like this. And he's like, I want the double bacon cheeseburger on top of another cheeseburger. And you're like, what are you compensating for? And that's what the world says is manly. That's manliness. And it can be very repulsive at times. But go to a story in 1 Samuel chapter 22. In 1 Samuel chapter 22, I think a really interesting thing that we can notice here is that when David was forced to flee from Saul, and again, we all know the story of David and Saul's relationship. You know, best friends at first, Saul, you know, becomes his father-in-law, tries to pin him to a wall with a spear, David has to run away, you know how it goes. You know how it goes with fathers-in-law, right? Right, Stephen? There's probably plenty of times he's wanted to pin me to the wall with a spear. But when David is fleeing from Saul, he's there in the wilderness. He's a nobody. He's a wanted criminal. And yet look at verse 2. And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. And now there were about 400 men with him. There was something about David that other people recognized was just awesome. When you were in distress, you went to David. There was a quality about him, his manliness, that other men were drawn to that. Other men were drawn to whatever it was, whatever his aura was. There's a kind of manliness that's repulsive, that's grotesque, it's overdone, it's inflated, it's fake, it's superficial. But there's another kind of manliness that makes other men go, I need to be around people like that. I need to learn from people like that. I need to follow a person like that. That is a leader, and that is a man. And the last point that we'll make is that manliness does not fit society's mold. True manliness, that is. You think of plenty of examples of what our culture would say is manliness. Everything from the violent womanizer to the drug addict, to the alcoholic, to the disconcerted, disconnected father, from the deadbeat. That's what our world says manliness is. You can watch any beer commercial and find out what manliness is. You can turn on any sitcom. You ever notice that in a sitcom? How the father or the husband in the sitcom is always like a pudgy, uninterested, like, just leave me alone, like, you know, Al Bundy, you know, just kind of a pudgy, lifeless, soulless person who would rather not talk to his wife, who doesn't care what his kids are going through, and is always complaining about not being able to watch the game and sit on the couch with a beer. Watch any sitcom, and that is what we are told manliness is supposed to be. So it's no surprise then, if that is our definition of manliness, it's no surprise that 78% of this nation's jail and prison inmates grew up without a father in their life. 78% of prison inmates did not have an active father figure in their life. Like, are we surprised by that? So again, when we read in 1 Corinthians 16, or 1 Kings 2, when the Bible says, act like a man, again, what is our definition of that? Let's go back to David one last time. When you look at David as a man, yes, he was brawny and strong. Yes, he killed a lion and a bear and killed a giant. He killed his 10,000 Philistines. He was good looking. He was handsome. He was everything maybe that the world would think of with a man in a typical sense. But is that what made him manly? It's interesting that this same man who could kill lions and bears and giants also had a very, very tender side. And it was his tender side that defined him more than anything else. Notice his grief in Psalm 51. When he had an affair with Bathsheba, when he had her husband killed, when he lied about it, tried to cover it up, and when an infant died because of his sin, David never looked at Bathsheba as a triumph. He never looked at Bathsheba as a conquest. David was not going around the locker room telling stories to his buddies about Bathsheba. No, Bathsheba was an open wound for the rest of his life. Psalm 51 shows the tender side of him by showing his grief when he sinned and hurt other people because of his sin. True manliness means accepting and admitting when you've sinned. And actually feeling bad enough about it to change. His love of music and poetry, with God being the center of his artistic pursuits. It's not just a matter of learning to play the guitar. It's not just a matter of writing poetry, roses are red, etc., etc. But when you make God the center of your interests, God the center of your hobbies and your pursuits, when God is the center of your art, that's true manliness. His deep emotional attachment to other men, which in our culture makes us uncomfortable. We read about David and Jonathan and we kind of go, oh, that's nice, but we cringe a little at it still. Well, that's a good example, but I don't know if I want to have a relationship with another man like that. No. David was deeply, emotionally, and affectionately attached. And he didn't see it as a sign of weakness that he was. His sensitivity to other people's pain and his honesty about his own. He knew when other people were hurting, and he was empathetic. His devotion to prayer and meditation, that he was a man who actually brought things before God and wanted God to be an active part of his life and his problems and his pursuits. His devotion to God's law. Read Psalm 19 sometimes, and you'll know what his attitude was about God's law. God's law is perfect. God's law completes the soul. God's law is sweeter than honey. God's law is more valuable than gold, even the finest gold. That was David's attitude about obeying God's law. His zeal for public worship. Go to Psalm 84 sometime. And when you read Psalm 84 verses 1 through 4, David is even envious of little birds that get to nest in the sanctuary because they get to be there all the time. That's how much he longed for worship with God. So are you a manly man? Are you raising manly men? Are your sons going to be manly men? And what examples are you looking to know just what it means to be a man? Men are on the defensive. We are being beaten down. We are being pulverized by our society's preconceptions, by our society's mold. Now, are we going to break that mold and show just what it means to be manly by God's standard, not the world's? Now, the first thing that you can do, if you're not a Christian here this morning, is submit to God and obey His will for you. To become a Christian, you must be baptized. That's hard for men to accept. It's hard for men to stand before other people and confess Jesus as Lord. It's hard for men as well as women, but I think men have a difficult time humbling themselves to the point of accepting that they need someone else's help. You need Jesus more than anything else. So if you have any need at all this morning, then please come forward as we stand and sing.